Yeah, I've turned it over 6 times. No, I don't think so. I had another tape I took out. Not for me to keep track. I haven't said anything worth taping anyway. But you guys all took such great notes that if Sarah wants to know anything, she just has to ask you, right? Yeah. All right. Anyway, it was clear early on that there were going to be some problems determining what 7i was going to be. So in 1974, I think, Nana and Doyon decided to sue each other. But it was supposed to be sort of a friendly sue, and where we said, look, it's sort of hard to determine exactly what we're supposed to do. For instance, if we get $1 million from an oil company, do we share the whole thing? Okay, it says revenues. Revenue generally means what comes in. So you could say yes. But let's say that in order to get this $1 million, we had to spend $50,000 in legal fees. We had to spend $5,000 traveling people around. We hired another consultant for $10,000 to help us look at what lands ought to go under it. Those are costs. Now, should we get to deduct those, or do we have to put it all under our 36%? Who gets to pay? Does everybody share in the costs as well as the benefit, or just the owning region? If the owning region has to eat all these costs, there does not a lot of incentive to ever go do anything. So we wanted to talk about that in court and get a court to sort of say, well, you know, what the deal was. So we started out, and actually, initially, I can't remember how it was, Nana took the position that we got deductions, and Doyon said, no, you didn't. In the middle of the lawsuit, we both changed our positions. But at any rate, that was going along. Well, and the reason that Nana was involved is because Nana was the first person to sign an agreement. We signed the oil agreement with Chevron.
Where did you get
this? I wasn't here then, I don't know. All I know is there was some change because Nana figured out that, the main reason we did it was because, as you'll see when I start going through this, once you start down the road of allowing deductions, then you got to start making a cut as to which deductions. And that's where it becomes hard. If you make no deduction, it's just real easy to figure out what you share. So about the same time, Arctic Slope started to get some substantial sums of money. We were talking about like $4 or $5 million in bonuses. They were talking about $20 million or something, eventually $33 million of money that the oil companies just paid them up front to lease their land. And Arctic Slope came along and said, look, we got this $33 million, but none of it's shareable. And there are a whole bunch of reasons why it's not shareable. It's not shareable because 7i says that the revenues have to come from lands that are patented, and there's no patent yet. It's not shareable because we got a lot of this money we're getting is for surface damage for subsistence resources, even though all these guys were going to do, for the most part, was fly around and do seismic work and a little bit of drilling. There clearly wasn't any. Plus, we have a whole ton of expenses that we have to write off, so really none of this is shareable. Well, clearly some of it was. So what happened was, rather than sort of the friendly suit that Diana and Nana had, a couple of regions that really wanted Arctic Slope money we had our case in Washington. They filed a suit here in Alaska, involved all of the regions, and off we went to the racetrack. And at this racetrack, there was only one winner, the attorneys. And they won big. Because over a period of about almost 10 years, I've never been able to add it up, But my guess is the regional corporations among them spent somewhere between $10 and $20 million on legal fees fighting over what 7i meant. And just a ton of money, way more money than was shared up to that point. And it was great for the attorneys. I mean, they were flying around the countryside, taking depositions, which are asking people questions, Barrow, San Francisco, charging first class tickets, and charging, you know, 10 hours a day at $150 an hour. I mean, it was just a great boon for the attorneys. Of course, just a mess for the native corporation. But several times, I would guess probably a dozen or more times during that period, various people tried to resolve the problem, tried to bring the corporations together to solve it themselves. Because it came clear that if we left it in the courts, at least to some of us, if the courts were going to solve it, it would take, well, it would never be solved. Because the courts can't make law, they can only interpret law. And what you've got is not only a problem with law, but facts. For instance, if this is $5,000 of travel that Nana tried to charge off, if that trip went from Anchorage or Kotzebue to Anchorage to Juneau to Seattle to San Francisco, and as well as meeting with the oil companies in San Francisco, in Juneau we went with the legislature, and in Anchorage we met and did some business, how much do you write off? How many pencils can Nana charge on? I mean, you know, is toilet paper for the office a legitimate charge? I mean, literally, one regional corporation charged toilet paper into 7i. And it was that kind of nonsense. And if you left it in the courts, it was never going to be resolved. As I said, a number of people, John Schaefer, Willie, people from Doyon, Tim Wallace, Sackett, 4,000, Roy Andor from Cooking, a number of people at different times tried to solve it. But it couldn't be solved. It didn't seem. But all during this period, we were just paying more and more legal fees. And finally, we got to a point in 1980, I guess, or 81, I can't remember what it was, when we started a trial just to talk about people's deductions. Just what are we going to deduct? Cook Inlet had something like, I think, $9 million worth of deduction so far that they'd racked up. And Arctic Slope had a similar amount. Well, to do this, it meant that somebody was going to have to sit down and go through every scrap of paper and look at it. And they hired what was called a special master out of New York at $250 an hour. Who was supposed to look at that. And then there would be teams of lawyers arguing with each other whether this toilet paper was legitimate or not. I mean, that's where we were headed. Finally, in April of 80, I guess, April of 81, Byron Malott called a meeting of all the regional corporations in on the Warm Springs Reservation in Oregon. He said, look, we've got to get out of Alaska. He said, I want every region to take two or three of their top people. We prefer not to have lawyers, but we'll let them come if you want. And we're going to go sit for 3 days and talk about this. And if any region doesn't feel they can afford to go to Oregon, Seal Alaska will pay their way, because we think this is important enough that we all got to sit down and talk about it. Out of that 3 days, came a basis of an agreement, which took about a year and a quarter to finally put together. But what's important about that agreement is it was an agreement that was not put together by lawyers. It was written by lawyers. But the key elements were negotiated by the native leadership. It was the native leadership that solved this problem, a problem that I don't think the courts would have ever solved. And there were some very difficult sessions. I mean, people literally yelling and screaming at each other about different positions and threatening to walk out and threatening to do this. But, and what was even more interesting to me was when we were apart, when we weren't meeting, there were all the little groups that would meet together. There was a sort of a Bristol Bay alley, who else was involved in that? I don't know, three or four that were involved, and they'd go off and meet
and they'd sit there and complain about Arctic Slope and about Cook Inlet or somebody else, and then you go to talk to Cook Inlet and they tell you what terrible people Driscoll Bay was. Nana had a great position because all we ever said was, look, we believe in sharing. We wrote the first 7i checks. We wrote them back in October of 1976. We were the first region to share. We said, we need to settle this. But we don't care if it's, you know, which way it cuts, you know, if you get more deductions or less deductions or more revenue, let's just solve it. But there were some real, obviously the people that had lots of money said, we don't want to share very much, and the people that thought they weren't going to get, have many resources of their own, wanted to get as much of Arctic Slopes and Ceres as they could. And as I said, while we were apart, people were always picking on the other side. But when you put everybody into a room, and they really had to sit down and face each other, although there were some very difficult sessions, they worked it through, because there was a lot of respect that was gained for people, and some people who really hadn't worked together before. Like, I don't think the Alleys had ever worked with Arctic Slope. You know, they didn't know them, and the mayor's leadership came to know about it. Well, as a result of all of that, after a year and a quarter, we put together a 125-page agreement to explain two sentences. And the lawyers, of course, did get a little bit of share. You know, you can't keep them out. But what's really important about the agreement to me is that there is now a penalty if you get caught cheating. We set out some very complicated rules, but before there was no penalty for cheating. If you had money, you were best off keeping it and make somebody sue you to give it up. Right now, if you're caught, let's say that you're supposed to distribute $2 million and you only distribute $1 million, and somebody, first of all, you don't go to court, you go to arbitration, which is a one-step process. If you go to arbitration and you prove that you didn't share enough, then you pay what you owe plus interest at prime plus 5%. So now prime rate is pretty ordinary interest. In most regions will borrow at prime plus one, maybe prime plus five is a real penalty.
Prime
is an interest rate that's set by banks. So it's sort of the average interest rate that they charge their best borrowers. Right now it's around 12%. A couple of years ago it was up around 18-20. It's been recently as low as 10. I guess it's 11%. Anyway, so there's a measure. So there's a penalty. Plus they got to pay all the costs of whoever challenged. So hopefully it'll work.
Did you do like $100 or $1,000?
Well, yeah, let's say that, well, I'll do $1 million.
$10.
$10 example doesn't work because you got to find somebody cheating for at least $100,000 or it doesn't count. Because we didn't want to pay lawyers to fiddle around for $10. What you wanted to do was go out and catch people for big money because lawyers can always bill you for nonsense. But let's say it's $1 million and let's say it's Nana that doesn't share. And let's say that we were supposed to share on September 30, 1983, okay? Which is the date that we pay out. You pay out once a year, okay? All right, so we don't pay. Well, regions have 2 years to challenge us after this date. So let's say they wait around for a year. They challenge us, we argue for 2 years. Let's say it's 3 years. So in September of 1986, it's determined Nana owes another $1 million. So we would pay that $1 million, plus we would figure the prime rate. Now this is sort of a complicated, so I'm going to take an average. And let's say the average rate was, the average prime rate was 12, plus 5, so it's 17% per year. So you would take 17 times $1 million, which is
No, 170,000. Yeah, 170,000. Okay. Times 3 years. Yeah, it's each year. It's prime.
It's each year.
Yeah. 2 years. All right. So rather than paying $1 million, we would be paying $1,510,000 for cheating. Plus, in addition, let's say it costs the other regions $60,000 to fight us, we'd pay that too. We'd pay for their attorneys and their consultants and anybody they had to hire to prove that we cheated.
How would they know they're cheating?
Well, because every year when we send out our checks, we send out a report. And we say, this is what we did. These are our agreements, this is what our income was, this is what our expenses were, this is how we figured it out. And then if any region wants to come and inspect our records, they have the right to come and inspect our records.
Does every region just send out a percentage of what they make, or do they all send out the same amount?
Well, it's all basically now they all sort of send out different amounts, but
this is all for deposits. There's oil,
oil, timber for regions, lead and zinc,
gravel, everything included in that.
We have sand and gravel.
Who has sand and gravel?
Well, right now the regions have it. We're in the process of trying to negotiate with the villages to maybe give them some of it, and in exchange for them supporting us going to Congress and getting the 7i agreement okayed by Congress so we can't get sued by villages on the 7i agreement. Anyway, to get back to your question, 30% gets to be kept, okay?
Of all the revenue?
Of all the revenue each region gets each year for 7i, okay? And then 70% of it is shared with all the regions, including yourself.
That's all the profits.
Yeah, essentially profits. Yeah, so you get to take deductions. It's not the income, it's the profit. That's not profits from business, it's just the profits from, like, if Nana does Red Dog. We don't have to share our profits from our drilling rigs or anything like that, just like Red Dog or Siri has oil.
How do you draw a line or a definition of what you can put?
Well, I mean, when people keep track of their businesses, they keep track of each little division separately, so it's pretty easy to do. And we don't just shovel all of our money into one account. In your annual report, you'll see that we often report by business and by categories. And we keep it not only by business, but within the business, we'll have sometimes a dozen different categories for expenditures. But anyway, what the difference comes in sharing is here, because regions are different sizes and they get to keep some. For a region like Nana, we'll get to keep about 6% of our own money down here. A region like Sea Alaska would get to keep, I think, about 15%. A region like Otna would get to keep like 1.3% or something. So different regions do send out different checks for the 70%. Again, based on, population. But at large, people don't get an equal amount. They get just an amount per person. Just like I showed you how we divided it up before, it's $500 per person. Well, that's because they're not in villages. Well, but this is something that, because this 50% is just split like the other money and it goes into village corporations and they're not in a village corporation, that's where it goes for them. Well, I think not in the long run. I think it's in the short run, right now, they've had a much better deal than anyone else, you're right, much better. I think if you look at it 10 years from now, I think you'll find that they're not, that people with the stock and the dividends are the ones that are going to be getting the most. And they'll only be getting a little bit.
Is this unique as far as
main
businesses anywhere?
You mean the sharing? Oh, yeah. Unique as far as anything. That I know of.
There are no Indian tribes that I know of.
Well, I take that back. There may be some. I'm not sure. I'm not. Nothing like this where you have 12 different entities. You often have revenue sharing between governments, like this on federal lands in the state gets part, the federal government gets part, sometimes the municipalities get part. You'll have that. Sharing is not a unique kind of thing, but nothing that's complicated. That's all usually pretty simple because it's just straight royalties. Well, actually, I think one guy did get close to $1 million. The guy that was on the pipeline, actually. But he's sort of an exception. I mean, sometimes people just wanted to sell it. And there aren't very many. I don't know all the names on that. They're mostly ones I know about.
I heard there was a corporation that had some $25,000
dividends. It's a village corporation.
Who?
A village corporation. One of the village corporations in Southeast, and they had.
It was
Cape Fox or Saxon. And they had a good timber deal, and they had very few shareholders. And they made a profit and they shared it. That's better than the at-large shareholders. No, they only got that one share. And the timber market's gone to hell. All right, that's.
When after we got back, Karen, Enoch, and I, we met with Tony St. James, and we talked to him for so long. And then we talked to John, and one thing we were thinking about, that organization that you guys wanted to form or put together, we still need to get some kind of name together. And here's some suggestions, but I'm not sure, so maybe Karen can.
I can help you.
Do you have a paper, Stephen?
You're not finished.
I need to make one or two phone calls, and I would like to come back. But why don't, if you guys got some business about the student thinking, why don't you do that and I'll come back then on it.
Okay.
Maybe you guys can ask other questions. Fair?
Fair. Thank you.
Did you say anything?
What was this again? I need
no,
where,
it's not true.
How for me again?
These are some suggestions of names for our community.
What's the committee and what's going on there?
Informally, we inform this. We call it
Empowerment
Committee. The law of returning colleges. For all.
Just figure it out.
I've seen something else.
What happens to the allotments after entering, when are they taxed?
The allotments cannot be taxed because the allotments are trust land.
Yeah,
allotments don't have anything to do with the claim tax. Now, I say they're not taxed. They're trust land right now. A person can get them out from under trust status. Right now, you know, if you own an allotment and you want to sell it or lease it or anything else, you have to get the permission of the BIA to do it. So if you want it not to have the BIA overseeing you, then you take it out from trust status, but then it can be taxed. So it's a real advantage for keeping it from trust status.
Is there any treaties
still on time? Up here? The only sort of treaty in Alaska that I'm aware of was a treaty that we signed with Metlakatla. Metlakatla's down. Yeah, right down here, south of Ketchikan. That was a treaty with a group of Indians that came over from Canada with a priest. Settled out of Canada, and they got title to an island. They are not part of the Settlement Act. At least the people that are enrolled in Metlakatla are not. And they kept their separate reservation. They are a reservation with the same kind of relationship that reservations in the South 48 have. Let me just sort of check on what you guys would like to do with all this. I right now could go into the tax situation, which will probably take us half an hour or 40 minutes, and then we could break for lunch, get through most of the items on my agenda, and we could come back after lunch if you wanted to, or not come back. I'm going to be here till 5:15.
Yeah,
so,
let's come back.
Yeah, let's all come back. This kind of information will help us in the future. Maybe in the days, the weeks, months.
All right. Well, why don't we do this? Why don't we take questions for a while longer? This is sort of general questions, and I'll start the class right after lunch. So, we'll be fresh.
I've got one question. How does the Department of Interior get into the IRA government?
Well, the part of the federal government that deals with Indian issues is the Department of Interior. Within the Department of Interior is the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The Bureau of Indian Affairs is sort of the direct operating responsibility. So the IRA's report to the BIA, the Secretary of Interior is responsible for everything that the BIA does. So sometimes you'll hear people talk about the trust responsibility of the BIA, sometimes it's hear them talk about the trust responsibility of the Department of Interior or the Secretary of Interior, they're all the same.
How do you need
it? That's the real thing. I knew that was the main issue.
But we haven't even discussed, have we? That's something we're going to have fun with this afternoon.
I haven't even heard the windmill substance last night.
You haven't? Yeah. Well, it's mentioned, but it's not directly. We talked about parts. That's a milk. I don't like the word, so it's not nearly safe for that. And Nelka, really, for the claim back, it was a series of amendments. When I get to the tax issue, you'll hear it mentioned again, because there were a couple of very key amendments relating to the tax issue. Let's save 7i for this afternoon because it goes with money, and I promise you I might do money this afternoon too, as well as tax.
Does everybody understand what 7i means?
7i is a section of the Act which says that if you develop surface, or if your regional corporation develop timber or subsurface resources, you get to keep 30% of the money you make, and you share 70% with everybody, including yourself. And this afternoon I'll show you how that sharing takes place and why this became one of the 7i has so far been the most difficult part of the claims act, we figured out, also the most expensive. But also, 7i, if for some regional corporations right now, their future, people like Kern Creek, Tony Ag, probably wouldn't survive without the money that the rest of us will pay them.
But
you don't take money from the village corporations, but some of the money goes to the village corporations.
So revenues from that road,
well,
it's
Not the road itself, probably, but the bar. We use sand and gravel up there to build the road. It's going to be a little bit complicated because it relates to a land trade. We'll probably do, and KIC may be involved in the land trade, and anything that KIC is not 7i, anything that belongs to Nana is 7i. Also, there's some talk of taking sand and gravel out of 7i.
When are you going to get the grub?
They'll take, you know, probably have marl pits along the route, either crush rock or a couple of places where they are with this route.
You're talking about reserve lands, like in the meantime, and you said they only have the land of corporations
and just the village. There's no region involved in all that.
How many village corporations do you have
in our area?
Yeah.
There used to be 11, there's now one. One other region, as John said last night, that merged almost all the villages, and that was Otna. Some other regions, villages have merged among themselves and formed larger corporations. The villages around Antioch did that, some around Galena, some in the lower Kuskokwim. Koniag, which is a regional corporation for Koyak, tried a merger with six of their villages. They did it very poorly. They ended up getting sued. They have virtually bankrupted their own corporation in the process, as well as destroyed, probably, or come close to destroying four village corporations. It's one of the biggest messes to complain about. And basically, it was because, well, when NANA merged, and I think also when OTNA merged, because I was involved in that, the idea about merger was bringing people together. We're the same people. The people of what are members of the village are the people that are members of the region. They're not different, they're the same. So, you know, why fight each other? In Kodiak, they didn't approach it that way. They approached it the way non-natives would approach it. They approached it just as a business deal, and because there were some things about the business deal that were, in my mind, a little bit shady. They didn't tell all the things they should have told when they sent out the information, the proxy information about the merger. And they got sued and they lost. And it has been, it's made a lot of rich lawyers and a lot of poor shareholders.
What's the likelihood of
Nana
and
KIC? I'm not the one to ask about that. It's still being talked about. I mean, there's no question that the KIC is, it's financial. If you look at it from an economic standpoint here, I think financially capable of staying on their own. If you look at it as bringing people together, then that's a bigger issue. And I don't know if it's a big thing about that. KIC has done, I think, very well. It's done a lot better than some regional corporations.
Of the 12 regional corporations, who is the bottom line? Financially, I know there's one.
I mean, who's the best or who's the worst?
Who's the worst? I mean, financially
the worst off right now is a close race. it used to be that Bering Straits was the clear winner. They got out early and managed to lose virtually all of their money within the first 3 or 4 years of the plane. Not only their own money, but managed to spend a lot of their village's money and with it. They have spent the last 6 or 7 years trying to make up for it and just hold on. So they used to, in my mind, be financially the worst off. And I'm going to have to look now at what's happening in Kodiak because they're trying very hard to be in just as much trouble as the Bering Straits. The difference is that Koniag does have timber,
that timber is a harvestable resource, and if the timber markets come back, they do have an opportunity to make some immediate revenue, whereas Bering Straits does not have that kind of opportunity.
Was it just having that investment?
It was atrocious management.
I'd
be both, in my mind, by the board and certainly by the key executives, and particularly the president of the corporation, who is a non-native, they hired him outside the state.
Don't board corporations have oil reserves, huh?
Kodiak and Bering Strait?
Yeah.
Well, not on their land. The oil that's being talked about around the Bering Straits area is oil that's offshore out here. They don't own any of that land. Now, it might benefit in terms of leasing shore facilities or doing service work, like NANA does service work at Pluto Bay, if any oil is found. That would help them. On the other hand, they don't have a lot of money to invest. I mean, NANA got into businesses on the North Slope by having some money we could put into things like building drill rigs or buying a camp, things like that. Bering Straits doesn't have money left to do that. Kodiak had some oil leases over here, but I don't, to my knowledge, something's been found over there. And I think they gave most of that land up.
Who's the most profitable region in Guyana?
Cook Inlet. Cook Inlet, and Cook Inlet will be for quite some time, I think, because they are producing oil and gas properties. Now, they have to share a fair amount of that with us. They made $15 million profit last year, I think. They worked real hard. They started out with very, very bad land, most of it glacier tops, mountains. They negotiated, and the government changed that. Gotten some good land, a lot of good resource land, and the fact that they're doing well for the most part will benefit all of us because a lot of their revenues are going to be 7 miles share of the revenue. Seven-night's always been in effect. The question is, if you'll find out this afternoon, what does it really mean? The agreement is in effect. Oh, they've had some shaky times. I haven't looked at the financial statements for that recently, but they're a small region. They're spread out. They don't have much resources. They had some bad management early on, but I think they've recovered. They're looking. I think they're okay.
Where does NANA stand?
Well, I would say NANA's always considered near the top. We have, I think, been consistently the most profitable. We've run a profit, I think, each year in the last 8 years. The year we're just finishing, which ended on June 30th, will be by far our best. We'll make somewhere between $4 and $5 million this last year. It's the most we've ever made by before, $1.8 million. And I would guess that would put us number two this year in terms of profit. The problem is the regions have different fiscal years, not all the same.
Yeah.
But, and I think, and you know, we've paid dividends the last, like 5 years. I just had a couple of Bristol Bays done that. I mean, one of the NANA's was, we've always considered it very important to make a profit because we knew we can't survive. But as John said last night, that's not the most important thing we do. And I think NANA has one of the, in some ways, a very, maybe the best reputation in the state of combining the cultural aspects of what we're doing with the profit-making aspects. And I think that's where nobody comes close to that, is doing the two together. There are some that make more money than we do. There are some that are as interested in culture. I think in many ways we've been more progressive, but people can, there have been reasons quick to pick up on ideas we had, and we picked up on that. But I don't think anybody's combined the two together. There are a lot of reasons. We talked last night a little bit about why some regions have problems and others don't. NANA happens to be a pretty easy region to manage. We started out with 11 villages. We've only got 4,700 people. We're all the same culture. And look at somebody like Cook Inlet, who everybody packed into Anchorage. We're village-based. They got Chalista, they got
55, 58 villages, no resources. So this is what happened there in Oregon, especially when you come.
You sell
these,
right?
Talk about money, I keep skipping taxes, but I'll get to taxes before we quit this afternoon. This shouldn't take too long. Basically, when the Claims Act was passed, Congress said there was $962.5 million, almost $1 billion, set aside as part of the Claims Act. This money was to come from two sources. Come from the federal, $462 million of it, more or less, will come from the federal government, directly from Congress, over an 11-year period. And it was spelled out, like the first year there was $12.5 million, I think the second year was $30 million, then it went up to $70 million a year for a few years, and then back down. It was sort of, if you looked at how the money came, it sort of started here, went up, and then went down like that. Just to sort of give you a little bit to get started, build it up, get the money in here, and come down. 11 years. The other $500 million was to come from natural resource revenue, pretty much oil revenue, really, from both state and the federal government. The state paid most of that. I think of the $500 million, I guess the state paid probably $425 million, mostly out of prudent effect. Okay, that's the money that came. Any questions on that? Well, that's the next step.
What does the state have to pay for?
Well, that's an interesting question. It was a big fight because previous to this, states really had never been asked to participate in an Indian settlement. It's usually a federal settlement. The state government said, look, this is not our problem, this is a federal problem. Leave us alone. Fed said, look, you got all this money in Prudhoe Bay, and it looks to us like Prudhoe Bay's not going anywhere. You can't get a pipeline built until this issue settles so you guys will participate. As I mentioned earlier, we had asked, the Native community had asked, for a 2% royalty, what we call overriding royalty. And that's actually what we got. The $500 million was based on a 2% royalty on all federal and state oil and gas. So we asked for it for perpetuity, and what they gave us was the 2% royalty up to a maximum of $500 million. When Keith Miller was governor, he actually opposed that. When Egan beat him back in 1970, Egan changed the state's policy and agreed to pay, agreed to state participation. Royalty is a part of something. So like you, the state gets $100 million a year, we get 2% of it. Or $2 million. And that's how the $500 million was scheduled to come. It was scheduled to come based on 2%. Actually, what happened, we got to the point where the state owed us a little over $300 million. We knew the state had a lot of money, and we asked them to pay us off early, and they did. We actually got paid off about a year and a half or 2 years earlier. Okay, what happens to the money? For the first, there was a difference. The first 5 years of the act, one thing happened. That, during that time, basically what would happen is the money would go into something called the Alaska Native Fund, which was managed by the Treasury. So whether the state the money came from the federal government or the state government, would go in here. Once every 3 months, the feds would distribute, and it would go to the regional corporations. Based on enrollment or population. So how much money you got depended on how many people you had. Once the regional corporations got it, they had certain responsibilities. For the first 5 years, 40